are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and friends right here in sunny Coco, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and we are heard on the World Wide Web at www.wwbc. Ellen O'Neill is not here today. Ali Tambor is filling in for her. Ali, welcome, and thank you for filling in for Ellen.
Not a problem. We're tickled to be here. It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. The skies are blue and gorgeous clouds, and we're all working on getting out the vote.
So today we have an action-packed show. My friend Stephanie Vanos is here, and Scott Hottenstein. I hope I said it right. And
you did.
Stephanie and Scott and I met at a Democratic gala here in town a few months ago, and it's amazing how you can have like-minded people at your table and not even know it until you open your mouth and you say hello. So welcome Stephanie and Scott, and they're with the Democratic Public Education Caucus of Florida.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Scott looks like he's tongue-tied. Scott, thank you and welcome for coming to be on our show today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they took a ride in from Orlando. I think they're the ones who went to New York City, not me, because he looks tired. So I returned from New York City, and I'm just grateful to be back right here in our studio with Danny and Allie and Scott and Stephanie. And we're going to have a great show today. We have an action-packed show, actually. So we sit here on Mondays from 1 to 2, and we speak about issues that are going on around the nation, what I like to call kitchen table topics. We speak about things that are going on right here in Brevard, in the state of Florida, around the nation, and in our world as well. And we all watched today the funeral for Queen Elizabeth, who was blessed to reside on this earth for 96 years.
Amazing.
And I know, Ali, you said you watched it, and Stephanie,
yes,
you watched a little bit, and so did you, Scott.
Yeah. My wife was watching it.
Yeah. And you know what was amazing to me is that the Queen worked up till like 2 days before her death. She was actually still working. And so it is the end of an era. And I watched, you know, this morning a little bit, and I saw the royal family, and I prayed for peace, and I prayed for the family to come together and for a world to come together. Because at the end of life, really and truly, is what you leave behind.
Yeah.
Your good name, your good deeds, and what you did for humanity, just like Scott and Stephanie. And before we go to Scott and Stephanie, we've got a gentleman who is on hold, and his name is Guy Akuri, and he is a PhD. He's an author. He's a public speaker. His website is absolutely wonderful and easy to navigate, and he's going to speak to us this morning on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends about relationships, obstacles, toxic relationships, how we can get away from that, and we'll talk about his book, A Son's Guide to Healing and Moving On. And I know you're on the phone, Mr. Guy, so thank you for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Thanks so much.
Well, so are you in North Carolina right now?
I am, yes.
Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit what's going on up there. I know you're planning for a wedding, and
yes.
How's your weather? I know you have a beautiful family. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what's going on in North Carolina today.
What's going on in North Carolina? There's a lot going on in terms of, well, I really don't know a lot of what's going on at the moment because all I do is prepare for a wedding.
Yes.
And so that's what I'm doing. And but we're, I decided to write this book as my mother was dying because I really felt like men needed a way to bond and to also understand without the risk that they may feel they have when they're trying to really work on how they can heal. And so my mother knew about it, and we reconciled at the end, but it was really a great adventure for me and very therapeutic.
Yeah, it sounds like it was something you had to do, like to just cleanse yourself, because you also lost your brother.
And my sister and my father, yes.
I'm sorry.
That's six and a half year period.
That's a lot for you to go through. I mean, my goodness, for you to survive that. So so talk to us a little bit about some of the valuable lessons that you learned while you continue to work, and then you still wrote this book. You had a moment when you said, I'm going to write this book, because you were listening to so many people's stories as you counsel them.
Yes. I've really worked into my own business plan to be a mentor to younger men and just to help them along in life. It's something that I was blessed with in my early 20s and early 30s, and I just felt like I needed to do that. And I actually belong to a group of 10 men who are at all times mentoring at least two younger men. And it's been really, really a great eye-opener to me that whether or not they have toxic relationships or toxic parents, they still need guidance, and they'll need to learn to own their own healing and their own, and take responsibility for their own life, and you know, kind of claim their life as their own. And so that, out of that came the book and helping my mother, even though she was terminally ill and she had really severed all ties with me and my brother. But she asked me to be with her in her last 6 months. And so I did that willingly, and it was a good time to heal and to learn those life lessons you were talking about.
Yeah.
I think one of the first lessons that I learned was that, you know, I'm not here to bash my mother in this book, and I also really understood that this is not me blaming her, but it's the fact that I have internalized and perceived the things that she did to me in ways that set me in a wrong path. And so it's really up to me to change my life. It's not up to me to fix her or to do, you know, do drastic things that, you know, really won't help me in the long run.
Well, with a PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, you also coaches, teachers, and school administrators. And when I listened to you, when I went on your website as well, I feel like you are a man of truth and grace and love, and you do have a calling to help others. Talk to our audience a little bit about your practice and how you're helping the teachers and, you know, other corporations and organizations so that people can learn from each other. And you hit it on the head. You said people teach and learn best if they're able to reflect on the how to do it.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that's, I really do prefer one-on-one. It's nice to give talks. I'm not that great of a public speaker, but I can really have a positive impact on people one-on-one, whether it's a teacher or a school administrator or a kid who is just trying to navigate getting that third job in 1 year and what to do with that. And so it's been really great for me to, especially with teachers and with administrators, to just help them to say, okay, this is what I'm doing, and this is, but what is it that I really want as a result? And then, and to help them reflect on why maybe they're not getting that result, or what is it about them that doesn't allow them to achieve that result? And so they really do, and teachers, especially when they're trying to improve their teaching, they really have to see how they're affecting others, but they don't really think about that. They think about, I have to teach well the way that I always learned, which may not be the right way. And so it's really helping them reflect in different ways so that they can come to a more fruitful decision and action later.
So for our listeners who are just tuning in, this is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and we're speaking with the author, Guy Akuri, and he is talking about his book, Toxic Mothers, A Son's Guide to Healing and Moving On. And you also have a workbook companion. Why the workbook companion?
Well, it's actually in the works, but there are some of the exercises in the book itself. But I hope to have just reflection exercises that help people to first identify toxicity, then identify toxicity in themselves. And then the only way really to change our lives, I think, is to become aware of these rules to live by that other people live by and that we live by, and to change them into things that we want to become with virtue. And so, you know, your mother may be very toxic to you because she believes she's going to get life out of some, you know, really, you know, terrible thing. And being toxic is just trying to enforce that rule that we think is going to bring us life, but in a really inappropriate way. And so I really think that people can identify that in others, but they have to first identify it in themselves and decide, what kind of person do I want to be? How can I change the rules that I live by that love others well and that create virtue in myself, create integrity in myself? Because that's really what we're responsible for.
Right. And you, we all talk about you can't heal others until you heal yourself, right? Because correct. we know we learn from history, we learn from education, we learn from each other. Lord knows we learn from life experiences. And in my case, I have 18 siblings. So we've had a lot of ups and downs and a lot of relationships with each other and toxicity and a lot of things. But yeah. You hit on something on your little video there, the short video. You talk about insulation versus isolation. And that mm-hmm. that really speaks to me, because there's so many people, so many cultures, actually, that don't speak about life or death or in between what happens. And do you uh-huh. find that people who communicate will be able to speak, and maybe before the end of life comes, maybe they can reconcile a little bit and learn to forgive? Why is it that some people just don't do that?
I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about insulating and isolating behavior. It's actually the next book I'm writing. I'm in the middle of writing a book on insulating and isolating behavior. And, you know, we become toxic because we don't know how we affect others. And we assume that what we're doing is righteous and right and good for us and for other people. But when we get outside of ourselves and admit, hey, I really am not loving this person well, then we can start to heal on the other ends of all those things.
Yeah.
I forgot the line of, but yes, that's essentially it.
Yeah, well, but because, you know, like a lot of faiths, a lot of cultures, they teach you about forgiveness. They teach you about mm-hmm. how to heal. And I know that maybe like the elders in some families, they have a vast amount of knowledge and experience to help others in the family, but people don't come to them. Mm-hmm. Because even if a mother or father is having a difficult time with children, maybe the grandparents could say, well, this is what's happening in that family and why this is what their line of thinking. Do you find in your practice that you're finding that people reach out to others in the family to help them to heal?
Yes, you know, in the psychology world, we become toxic because we isolate ourselves and we don't know what we're doing. And some therapies are to teach us to insulate ourselves with people who are healthy and that can encourage us. And my angle is a little different in that I think, you know, whether we only turn to our family or we only have people who say that everything we do is fine, kind of these yes people who just say, yeah, you're okay, even though they actually realize you're doing pretty bad collateral damage with, you know, the people along your path. And so I think it's very important for us to be conscious of our isolation, but we also need to be intentional about our insulation. You know, I'm sure your audience knows those families that only get input from their family. It's only family, 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 family. But, you know, that could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing.
Yeah, it's good to have that outside voice sometime. And I agree with you, because sometimes somebody from the outside looking in, a counselor, somebody like yourself, you know, could help that family better. So you talk about some of the tough questions that people ask themselves. And one of those questions, I think you hit it on the head, is like, are men and women really that different when it comes to healing from the trauma of their mother's toxic behavior? So tell our listening audience some of the behavior that you have seen, the roadmap, so to speak, what men and women do to avoid discomfort and reject their conscience and reject their entire life in order to heal, but they really don't heal.
Right. Well, I think that's two questions. Kind of, what is the difference between, or do men really need unique healing therapies? And the other is, what do we do? And I think it's dangerous to make generalizations, but for example, I think that men really do, they kind of exude the extremes of these six behaviors that lead them to isolate and insulate. They avoid discomfort. They reject their own conscience, and they reject their entire former life. In reaction to the toxicity, they just say, you know what, I'm going to do anything but what I was given. I don't care what it is, and they just reject it. Or they escape impulsively into other things, or they isolate, or they insulate. And I think that, you know, women do that too, but men are not socialized to talk about those things, to admit to those things, to form healthy relationships and contexts in which they can process and heal. Whereas I think women are given that. And the therapies that are offered for everyone are very female-centric. They're very, you know, let's all form a group. Well, men sometimes don't know how to form a group that shares vulnerably. And so the work to get healing out of a group for men, I think, is a little harder. Actually, the research shows it is a little harder to help men in groups than it is women.
So,
and just things like that.
So what you're saying is that men can self-sabotage due to when it comes to fear and grief, because they just don't know how to open up at times.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up, the fear and grief. And I think that men and women, or just people in general, but men specifically, handle grief and fear differently in this culture. And so men stuff it. They tend to obsess over the results. You know, the negative of results of what they might do, the negative impact. And so their fear and their grief take over in different ways than for women.
So when you were growing up, did you have someone that you could turn to, Mr. Guy, and talk to? Was there anybody, was there counseling, or maybe somebody who said, you need assistance with this? You know, because it sounds to me like you yourself saw something that you needed to heal yourself, and you didn't have that, and maybe this is why you reached out to other people.
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's really hard for young people to become that self-aware unless there's trauma.
Yep.
And so the first thing to say is, I think it was an evolution of me needing help from my sister caused a lot of problems in our family, and so we got family counseling, for example. But once my mother realized that we were being honest publicly with the family, she shut it down. But I remember the day she shut it down, because it was one of the most freeing things I think I was 12 or 13, to say, wow, you mean I can say whatever I want and there will be no consequence, and I can say the truth and not have to cover it up. And these are important things. But, you know, fast forward many years in life, my wife and I had really chronic infertility, and she handled it one way and I handled it another, but it really brought out the worst in me. And I discovered I was toxic and really hurting other people. And so, you know, full circle, I got counseling, and that counselor guided me to someone to be sort of a surrogate father, to help me to tell my story in a sane way and to let me kind of normalize what was going on in my life.
So what is the one takeaway from embracing your healing process? Because it sounds like you've had a journey and you're at a good place now, mm-hmm. Mr. Currie, and we can hear it in your voice. And that in itself is very comforting to somebody like me. I can feel that you're at peace. So what tell our listening audience a little bit about your how you embrace the healing process.
Well, I think we have to be honest, and we have to get input from other people. And my idea of healing involves three components. Once you equip yourself with really healthy rules to live by, that you're not demanding other people come through for you, then you need to jump into your life and be free to live it without the fear and shame of toxicity entering your life, because you now have that skill to identify it, to avoid it, to change it. Another thing you need to do is to welcome healthy input from other people and not just, you know, say family and just get advice from a friend who allows you to do the same things that you're ashamed of. And then ultimately, though, I think healing will come when you realize that you are loving poorly and loving well, and you know what that means. You can measure it, and I measure it by my definition of bold love. Bold love is to restore the relationship in another person, to restore that person to a better relationship with herself or himself, with you personally, with other people, or with their God. And as you interact and love others, you can leave just assessing whether or not that person is better with themselves, is better with you, is better with others, or is better with their God, and then continue to live your life freely, knowing that you are afforded the same forgiveness and opportunity and privilege to grow. And so that's the takeaway that I would hope people got from my book. And it's really what I focus on in young men who really don't think that way.
It's powerful what you're saying. It's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere where you had said that the best gift you can give to your parents, toxic or not, is to live your life well. But I would like to add to that the best gift you can give, not just to your parents, is to yourself as well. Right? Because life itself, every day that we wake up and open our eyes, is a gift just to be alive. And we've had instances in our own family where, because my father had children before he met my mother, and my mother had children before she met my dad, and then they had us, we were 18 of us in all, we've had instances where we've had siblings that were very hurt because they couldn't live in the same house with my mother and father. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they had to be given away to live with other relatives. And mm-hmm. the hurt that came with that, it's up to today, it didn't go away. And you're right, the forgiveness has to come, but it has to come before that person hits the end of life. So how do we get more people to recognize that they hurt others and to start the healing process well? Give us your website or how someone can get your book. Oh. How can they get a hold of you? Because it sounds like you can help them.
Yes. Well, I hope I've made it easy. You can get my book on Amazon. You just need to Google or to look up Toxic Mothers, A Son's Guide to Healing and Moving On, or my last name, and it'll pop up. My website is just my name, www.guyarcuri.com, GuyArcuri.com. And, you know, there are things that I do there. You can sign up to mentor. You can sign up to be mentored. You can join a support group. But there are many things you can do on the website, but there's a lot of resources there that will take you to other places and other people and other sources to help you heal. So, and I think to answer your question one more way, the last question, I hope the takeaway is hope. We named our daughter Hope after many miscarriages and infertility issues, but I hope that people have hope. And that doesn't mean that you have to have a nice, sugary relationship with your mother. It just means there's hope for you to live a life that you think is worthy and that is valuable and that, you know, brings you joy.
Sometimes the entire family needs counseling, the mother and the son together. And that I think sometimes is very difficult for people to make that initial step, pick up the phone or go on the web and say, let's do this together. How would you get more people to say, well, listen, you can't heal by yourself? Because many times we hear these cultural sayings that people say, why can't you just suck it up and get over it? People would say, you just move on. But some people just can't move on. They do need the counseling and the help, right? How do you get more people to recognize that?
That's exactly why I wrote the book, is that I don't think people approach healing in a healthy way, because we're American and we want it to be just by ourselves and independent and all of that. But you really can't heal outside of the opportunity and the practice of attempting to love others well. And so, you know, not many people or books or therapies try to help you heal by sending you to people and asking them to be honest about the way you love people and love them themselves. And so I think it's really crucial to understand that this book isn't the healing, and you can't just like pick it up, but it gives you ways to think, especially for men. It gives you formulas and it gives you alliteration and cute writing and whatever it is to encourage you to find the right kind of healing. You know, do you need to heal mental illness? Do you need to heal addiction? Do you need to heal any of these other things? You need to go do it as part of your healing from this toxic, you know, reaction that you've had in your life.
Well, we're going to give you a couple more minutes, because this conversation, I mean, we're living in a world today where we see so much hate and division and fear and anxiety and depression with people coming out of COVID, and you add family relationships that went bad and toxic to this big bad world, and you've got people who need mental help and mental health counseling so much. So tell us, when someone says to you that you're supposed to have a warm, fuzzy relationship with your mother and your father and your siblings, what do you say to them when that person say, I just can't because, and they give you all these reasons why they can't? I'm sure you've had people like that came to you and say, I just can't. So how do you how does that person begin to heal?
Mm-hmm. That is most of the stories that I have in the men that I mentor, is that. It's like, but I'm supposed to love my mother. I'm supposed to, you know, she gave me life. And the thing is that, you know, there are other ways to think about it other than these rules to live by, which are just, you know, what do you think is going to bring you life, and are you demanding that others come through with that? That's a toxic rule to live by. But, you know, we can change that by setting boundaries. And so this book gives you, you know, resources to go learn about boundaries. And that's one thing you can do, is to begin to set boundaries. And boundaries really do help you gain the strength to live your life your way. And so that's great. Your mother may become more toxic, or she may change. I think my mother changed more and we reconciled more because she was terminally ill. With the experiences I've had with other men, their mothers are living and they're a nightmare. They're just as much of a nightmare as my mother was to us three children. And so you have to get a good, strong hold on yourself by attempting to love others well. And it might not include your mother, and that might be okay. But I also, in the book, give really practical ways to approach your toxic mother if you're trying to reestablish a relationship. And they're really great. You know, one is, I can run to my book here, and you can ask for forgiveness, but give it in return. You can ask for grace from her, but give her the truth of your life. And the reverse of that is also true. You can ask for grace, but give her truth, or you can give her truth, but you need to ask for grace. You need to ask for forgiveness yourself. There are things here to do that keep you on the path to healing while protecting yourself from...
Yeah, you almost like you have to have your own coping mechanisms. And I guess a person can't get there by themselves. They do need the counseling. And we would recommend your book to our listeners. My friend Ellen O'Neill will put it on our website when she comes back. Guy Okiri, this was really wonderful having you call in and speak with us on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And before you leave, just give us a website one more time where someone can find your book and sign up for one of your retreats or to join one of your groups. I mean, you're doing a lot of wonderful things to help humanity, and it's just wonderful that you're able to come on. So give us the website one more time.
The website is www.guyarcuri.com. And I'm at Instagram and Facebook at Guy Arcuri Path, P-A-T-H.
All right. Well, we are going to take a station break, and we'll be right back with our second segment with Stephanie Vanos and Scott Hartenstein.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you all.
They're needed fast. MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MedFast, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads. 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000. Or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends on AM 1510. Our dial is WWBC. We're heard on FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online right here on the web on WWBC, everywhere, all over the God's magnificent planet. People tune in to us in Ireland, in Canada, in the UK. You go on the web and you're just typing WWBC and you could hit listen live. Great show, Allie,
it's
so far.
It's just so wonderful. It's good to hear that I would make the assumption that a toxic mother and or a toxic father would either way be something that he could help with his stuff to straighten us out a little bit.
Using his own experiences,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so now our second segment is with my friend Stephanie Vanos and Scott Hartenstein. And boy, I'm so excited they're here with the Democratic Public Education Caucus of Florida. That word education has been in the news and on the web and in every social media platform, like for months now, public education. And so, Stephanie, I'll have you go first. Tell us a little bit about why you got involved with the Democratic Public Education Caucus of Florida.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us today, Sita. I think the easiest answer is I have three daughters. I have a daughter in elementary school, a daughter in middle school, and a daughter in high school. You can't help but to pay attention to what's going on in your schools when you have three kids moving through the public school system. And, you know, I've watched over the years just, you know, concerning actions that have, taken place in Tallahassee that have really impacted our local schools, our public schools. And I think, you know, my goal is I want people to care, I guess. I want people to understand what's happening and care and just understand what's at stake if we don't all act together to make sure our public schools are properly funded and, you know, make sure our kids have qualified teachers in the classrooms and make sure that all children are able to access a high-quality public education.
Right. It's about opportunity, right, Scott? So, Scott, tell us why you got involved with the Democratic Public Education Caucus.
So, I actually went to 14 years of private school growing up. My parents were decidedly middle class, but they made the sacrifice, sent me to private school. I went to the Naval Academy, graduated, and was in the Navy for 24 years. My wife earned her master's in school counseling at my last duty station, which was in Sicily, Italy, of all places. And when we retired, when I retired, the idea was, you know, Laura's career takes precedence, and she was in school counseling. We had two boys, and I had taught at the Naval Academy, and I'm like, maybe I could be a teacher. That would be interesting. And so I was a teacher for 7 years and ended up being a Teacher of the Year finalist in Hillsborough County.
Way to go.
And thank you. When I was in the classroom and I'd see things like the temperature's like 83 degrees, the kids aren't learning. Well, who do I yell at? How do I fix that? Mm-hmm. And I just kept going up the chain, like kind of like a good Navy guy.
Yeah.
And until I decided to run for office, and I ran for school board. And I learned running for school board that a lot of the issues are actually up in Tallahassee, and I ran for state representative. And after that, I became president of this statewide caucus, and we're just trying to advocate for pro-public education policies and to elect pro-public education candidates all around Florida.
Yeah, and I like that even though you ran and you, I never said that somebody didn't win. You came in second or third or whatever. You didn't place first. You decided that you were going to take that energy and channel it into something else, which this is why we're all on earth, right? It's a purpose-driven life. And so you said, well, even though I didn't win state rep or school board, I'm going to do something else that involves helping people to have equal access to a public education. And here you are. So yep. Talk to us a little bit. What else do we notice? Because I, like you all, like you and Stephanie, I am very middle of the road. I'm a very middle of the road Democrat, leans a little bit to the left, I have to say. And what I'm seeing is the people that we want them to care about making a plan to vote, oftentimes they let us down. So, Stephanie, how do we get more people to say, this is not only for Allie and Scott and Stephanie and Ellen and Susie and Mike, and this is about me too. So why aren't people having these conversations around their own kitchen table to say, let's make a plan to vote, and yes, put public education on the forefront?
You want to go ahead, Scott?
Anybody sure. Could answer that.
So when it comes to school board elections or state rep, when we think about public education issues, we always think about, you know, the parents. What do the parents want? And that's been parental rights and people showing up and yelling at school boards. That's been all in the news over the past year and a half. But what everyone needs to understand is that public education today is our economy tomorrow. Even if you don't have kids yet, you're a young couple or you're single, at some point you're going to have kids, and the public education system is going to be critical. If you're like me, my youngest son graduated last year from high school. So now I have kids who are done with public education. Well, it's critical to me because the students who are still in school today, or kids who are in kindergarten, in 20 years, they might be the certified nursing assistant who needs to take care of me, or they're going to be the ones making change at McDonald's. Just this morning, we were watching someone struggle with making change because someone gave a $100 bill and they're trying to count it out. And so public education touches everyone, and everyone accesses services that come from what we teach kids in school.
Yeah, and mind you, Stephanie, the teaching is not just at school. It's at home, right? The foundation for everything starts in our home. But the public, but being able to send your kid to a public school where you know it's well-funded, where there's, like you say, air conditioning, food, comfort, a library, books, teachers, well-paid staff. We are a village, right? And we should all care. So what's happening with certain school board members and people in Tallahassee that they're using public education now as a political pawn? We're all watching that play out. How do we fix this?
Well, I think you're right. And I think the reality is that, you know, over 85% of parents do not want politics in public education. And that's why we don't want to have partisan school board races. And we want to make sure that the decisions that are affecting your local school are made by the people that you elect. You know, they're made by the people who live in your district, the school board members. And, you know, they shouldn't be made by, you know, the politicians in Tallahassee who don't have that local interest that the people that you elect on your school board have. I also think parents are just honestly sick and tired of the yelling and screaming at school board meetings. You know, someone said it before and I love it. Like, let's make school board meetings boring again, right? Like, let's let's not have the, you know, screaming over these issues that really aren't the, you know, important everyday issues that are affecting us as a whole. I mean, a lot of these culture war issues, that they are important issues, but we need to keep in mind that what helps to solve the problem for public school is more funding and, you know, giving local control back to our school board members. You know, those are the things that will help to take care of some of these divisive issues that politicians have brought up for their own benefit.
Yeah, and Scott, Mr. Scott Hartenstein, I like saying his name, I could say it properly.
You did great.
What do you think happened these last couple of years that so much, the drama at the school board meetings? I mean, I don't remember a time living on God's magnificent planet when I've seen so much hate and division and chatter and drama at school board meetings. What happened? Like, who woke up one day and decided we are going to attack public education?
So, two things there. First off, I kind of disagree that there's been a lot of drama. If you go back to, you know, it's interesting, 85% of people want to keep politics out of public education, and about 85% send their kids, and they're very happy with their neighborhood public school. So when we say all the drama, it's really drama coming from a very small part of the population. And my second point would be, it's a plan. There are powerful special interests out there who look at our children and they see dollar signs, and they're looking to turn the public education budget into an ATM for rich people. So if you can demonize public schools and get more kids to go to charter school or voucher schools that are for profit, then that's money in someone's pocket. If you can get people, students and parents, really stressed out about college admissions and, we lost ground during COVID on our test scores, so now we're going to go and spend hundreds, thousands of dollars on tutors when it's natural that your test scores might slide a little bit when schooling was disrupted. So it's part of an overall plan.
It sounds like you're talking about fear.
Yes.
Because we saw a lot of fear with the mask mandates. Here in Brevard, there were lines. There were people. The people were sending pictures to each other about what was happening at our school board because people didn't want to wear the mask, and they were having a lot of issues there. But it sounds to me like someone cooked up a plan to put the fear into certain people And this is what's happening. And it's so wrong because at the end, it's all about having a community schools that our children can attend and attend safely. And you're right. My grandchildren attend public schools, and my son and my daughter are quite happy with it. And my four children attended public schools, and I have no issues with it as well. So you're right. I'm one of the 85% that had no issues with public school. So let's move on a little bit. We all want to help the public schools and the children who attend the public school, the students and the administrators and the schools themselves. But the larger picture is we need to have resources for infrastructure, resources into the community so the kids do come to school ready to learn. Stephanie, how do we get more people to understand that it's not only about public education, but it's about the infrastructure as well? It's about the socioeconomic issues affecting all communities, all zip codes.
Right. Well, I think, you know, people are focused on academic, learning of children, but the reality is kids can't learn if they don't feel safe, if they don't have, adequate nutrition, if they don't have a place to sleep at night, if they don't have a place to live. So I think once people understand that we cannot help our children achieve academically if they don't have these basic needs met, I think that's the first step. And I don't think that that everybody gets that or is maybe willing to commit the resources to solving those problems first. But unless we have that foundation, you know, your academic situation just can't improve. So I think that's one thing. And then I think what you mentioned, the infrastructure of schools, like literally the actual infrastructure of schools, like the buildings themselves, school safety comes up a lot. Well, I would say that your children, children need to be safe in school, not just from, violence or fights or those sorts of things, which are real issues that we can talk about, but also just the school structure itself. And we need to make sure that we're investing in our public schools. And right now we're seeing money that could be invested in renovating our schools and, building new schools that need to be built. And that money is going to charter schools. So I think that's an area where, we elect the right people, we can make a big difference.
Right.
The American Society of Mechanical Engineers gives Florida overall, our school infrastructure, a D. So we're one step away from just utter failure when it comes to school infrastructure. And we have a $4 billion shortfall every year. We need about another $1 billion to just operate the ACs, keep them running and maintained. And Florida's growing. We picked up an extra congressman in the last census, but we're not investing in building new schools. So we have a lot of students who are in overcrowded classrooms, and then the infrastructure can't keep up, and the room's warm, and it's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When you're just like, if you're hungry or you're couch surfing because you can't find affordable housing, if you're hot, you're not going to learn in that class. And teachers have to deal with that, but students are dealing with it even more.
So, you guys are with the Democratic Public Education Caucus of Florida. How do we get people to join your caucus, and what are the requirements for someone to become a volunteer or a member? Is there a website that they can join? Because, you are absolutely correct. Public education is the future of the United States of America, whether we know it or not. Whether it's trade, whether it's academic, whether it's joining the military, we all fall into education. An educated society is a well-informed society, a nation, right?
Yep.
So how do we get more people to join you guys? It's a lovely topic.
So our website is www.dpecf.org. So it's our kind of our acronym, Democratic Public Education Caucus of Florida, dpecf.org. You'll find us on Facebook the same way, on Twitter and Instagram, put a underscore 2022 after it, and you'll find us. And we would love to have people join. There's big join buttons on the website, on the Facebook page. And what we're looking for really is two things. We need people to be advocating in their local communities about funding issues, about the things that matter. So that could be going to school board meetings. That could be contacting your local representatives and advocating for pro-public education policies. It's amazing how many school board members we're electing who don't understand, they don't have the background in public education. And up in Tallahassee, it's really rare that they understand what's going on. So we need local members to inform our elected officials.
You need a voice.
Yeah, and
we
need
a voice in the community. And Stephanie, when we all met at the gala, we were talking about, you know, how we all think alike. And I always say there's a train of thought that, you know, a man and a woman are expecting a child. And everybody is so excited that the woman is pregnant. She's having this baby. But then after that baby is born, it grows into a human that has needs and wants. And having a quality education is one of the things that this child is going to need in order to succeed. Having healthcare, a good place to live, a great environment, social justice, emotional justice. I mean, how do we get more people to not just see it as it's me and mine, but it's all of us? You just can't care about a pregnancy. You have to care about the child when it's born as well.
Well, right. You know, none of us act independently. Some of us might think we do, but none of us do. We act as a community. And so public education, of course, is the economy tomorrow, but it's also our communities tomorrow. It's our civic engagement of tomorrow. And that impacts all of us.
Yeah. And I see, Allie, you wanted to jump in here because you have the experience we don't have. You've seen public education evolve over time.
Yes.
What were some of the things you saw growing up? Because, you know, it's sometimes I feel like it's going to get to a point where certain people will be able to send their children to school and certain people will have to make a decision whether I can have a functioning school bus or a proper school.
Yeah.
And it's going to be like the haves and the haves not. Who can have access to education and who can't?
Yeah. I was thinking back to elementary school in West Palm Beach, Florida. And understand that's West Palm Beach, which is several zeros off of your income from Palm Beach. So we were just the worker bees over there on the mainland. There was no air conditioning. We had a huge exhaust fan that sat in the window and sucked the air through. But it was my parents that cared. Show me what you're doing in school. What is it you're learning in math? What is it you're doing in English? My father got bent out of shape big time because they were talking several different base theories, like base 5, base 7. Oh, my dad went ballistic. You know, teach them something that they can go and make change at the grocery store
right.
Not that, you know. So I think it's an involvement of the whole family. Let me see your homework. What do your grades look like? And then they would praise in front of me to their friends, Allie made 100% on this particular test, and she's on the honor roll.
So more love, family getting involved.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it was a goal and a set goal for the family that we're going to get through this and we're going to get through it highly successfully. And here's what we're going to do next. Show me what you got. Let me check your spelling. I mean, it was an overall family push. And I think that makes a big difference. Yeah.
So they recognize the value of an education.
Exactly.
So
yes.
Scott, we're watching all, you know, the banning of books. We're watching all these counties that are asking people to come forward and apply for jobs to be a teaching assistant, a teacher, a bus driver, work in the kitchen. What has happened to education that we need all these people? Why so many jobs available in public education?
I think two things. Number one, and this might be number two, is teacher pay. The talking point is it's a record level of education funding in Florida. That's what the governor would say. When in reality, our education budget has decreased by 17.5% over the last 15 years.
Oh.
Teacher pay is down 7.4% over the last decade when you adjust for inflation. So our starting pay might be high, but then you have teachers who wouldn't get a pay raise for another, you know, 10 years after they start. But I know personally what caused me to leave teaching full time, I only substitute and do advocacy, is the lack of respect. I had a principal lie to my face about something that concerned COVID and my wife being exposed. Lied to my face. the threats of being sued, of being told that you're not professionals, the erosion of standards. Teaching is a profession. It has standards.
The belittling of the profession.
And attacking the profession, well, people naturally want to get out of the profession because we could take the low pay. We love working with the students, but then not getting the respect that we deserve for being qualified teachers, busting our butts to educate our future generations. I think that's why you
it's
see
hurtful.
A lot
it's
of
it's painful.
It. Yeah.
And Stephanie, we have 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask you, as a mom with 3 children in public school, and I had 4 children in public school at one time, you know, we're watching the Moms for Liberty who are talking about age-appropriate materials and banning of books, and they act as they're the only ones who care about a public education and children. I personally do believe that we have to be age-appropriate with materials for children. I do believe we have to have open discussions with our children based on their age. What has happened in that one group of mothers feel they're better than the other group of mothers when it comes to our children's education? Because that's just false. The messaging is just wrong about that. We all care about children and public education.
Right. We all care about children and public education, and every parent should have their parental choice. So it shouldn't be a small, loud minority of parents telling us that their choice should apply to my child. Well, I want my child to have access to all of the books in the library, and if there's a book I don't want my child to read, I'll decide that.
Exactly.
But I'm not going to decide what other people's children are going to read in the library. You know, when it comes to history, I want to have a full history. I want my children exposed to a full history of, you know, the United States so that we don't make the same mistakes again. Again, it shouldn't be a small minority of people making choices for other people's children, but claiming that they believe in parental choice. It's hypocritical,
right.
And people need to, I think, see that for what it is. And
right. Isn't there a meme that says, you're not really a parent if you didn't show up for the PTA meeting? You don't even know what grade your kid is in. You don't even know which books they need this semester, but yet still you're at the school board meeting and you want books banned. Well, that's kind of like what we see happening now. And I see Scott shaking his head. How many teachers have prepared their classrooms? And you know the teachers are who are going to the children and the parents who are going to show up. Because the rest are not. And that's heartbreaking for a teacher, isn't it?
Yeah. When every year, put in all that work and you see who shows up and who doesn't.
Well, we had such a great show today. And Danny, thank you for running our board. We had the Democratic Public Education Caucus. We had my good friend Stephanie Vanners and Scott Hotenstein on our show. And we had Mr. Guy Akiri, PhD, who called in and spoke to us about relationships. And he spoke about his book. And we will be back next Monday right here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Thank you. And thank you for listening.